DW Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum. My name is Connor Dillon. Whether we like it or not, whether you like it or not, every single one of us is moving toward a future where we travel way, way differently than we do today. And that, of course, includes the means of travel, so the aluminum thing that you put your body inside to go somewhere, but also the way we arrange those trips in the first place. And that is where we are going to begin our show today, with the first step of the journey, if you will, and it's in Sweden, which is where the state railway company has come up with, well, a new kind of train ticket, a very unusual kind of train ticket. John Lawrenson has this report from Stockholm, and just a forewarning, the report might just get under your skin.
Getting on a train with Christopher, who doesn't have a ticket. Well, he does have a ticket, but that ticket is in his hand.
That's correct.
Can you see that?
Sure.
The microchip?
If I press a little bit like that, you can see him move it in.
Slightly creepy. Mm-hmm. It's the size of a grain of rice.
That's right.
I've got you under my skin.
I've got you.
When the conductor comes to check his ticket, he holds up his hand and the conductor swipes it with her smartphone. Christopher Lovquist, head of a digital development team at the Swedish railway company SJ, is one of the 3,000 or so Swedish people who have had a microchip inserted in the fleshy bit of hand between the thumb and the index finger. Among the data stored in Christopher's hand is his SJ loyalty card number.
When they put their phone on top of the hand to check the ticket, the chip will send my loyalty number to the phone and it will check my loyalty number in the list of passengers and see that, okay, for this loyalty number, there is a ticket on this train.
When did you get chipped?
Must have been maybe 2 months ago now.
Did you hesitate at all? Did you think, do I really want to do this?
No, it was by that time we had decided to launch this ticket on the chip, and then I figured, well, yeah, I just must do it. It seems like a future thing to do. So,
how else do you use this chip?
We can use it for the printers and for the scanners. And
so you just swipe it over the printer and...
Yeah, instead of using my card, my ID card, I can use the chip. And then you can use it at the gym. It's just that my colleagues do, but I haven't been to the gym since I got this implant.
I tried so not to give in. I said to myself, this affair never will go.
A member of staff at the Stockholm startup hub Epicenter enters the building by swiping his hand over a sensor at the door. Some 150 of the people who work for the different companies based here have chip implants, including most of the people who run the place. It's the first time in the world there's been a concentration of chipped employees like this. I asked Patrick Mesterton, Epicenter's co-founder and CEO, if these chips would provide information about employees to their employers.
Not more than it is by using a credit card or your normal key fob. There's no GPS tracking and there's no one sitting and surveilling and looking at, did John enter this door or exit that door? Is he spending time on the toilet? None of that whatsoever.
It's obviously a possibility, isn't it?
I think over time anything is, right? Technology is growing at exponential speed, so whatever is here now, you never know what that's going to look like in 3 to 5 years.
The sun beats down on blonde, tan people with glasses of rosé chatting in a garden. Inside, a tall, bearded man with tattoos and holes in his earlobes that might remind older listeners of the round window in Play School pulls on a pair of sterilised rubber gloves. Johan Usterland is a body hacker, his term. Of all the chips in all the left hands in geekdom, he has inserted most of them. Another 20 at this wine and chip party.
So I'm just applying blunt force to the area to kind of numb it out and stop the brain from sending synapses from
looking.
That area.
Hasn't even started yet.
Oh, another. That's it. Super quick.
Yeah, it hurts a bit and there's a little bit of blood.
A whole drop.
That, you felt that, huh?
Yeah, I felt it.
Yeah. It's quite a big blade going in your hand.
I don't know. I'm trying to just make the world more effective and more convenient. Everyday interaction with digital surroundings shouldn't be analog, should be digital.
Where do you see this going?
No limits, basically. The only limits right now is bureaucracy.
Are we on our way to becoming hybrids between human beings and robots?
I mean, this was super extreme when I started talking about it 3-4 years ago. Like, oh shit, you're gonna be tracked. Big Brother, CIA, NSA, KGB. And now it's in the common room. I mean, you're talking about, oh yeah, I heard about that. You can open your doors, ride the train, pay for stuff. So making that transition from extreme to not as usual, kind of day to day, that's gonna put the super extreme one step closer to the middle, right?
The next stage, making the rest of the Swedish travel system cyborg compatible, so you can enter the Stockholm Underground with a wave of your electronically enhanced hand. John Lawrenson, DW, Stockholm. Got you under my skin.
Well, we are going to stay inside someone's skin, kind of. Just a few weeks ago, something kind of amazing happened in France. A man there partially woke up from a vegetative state that he had been in for 15 years. I'm going to say that again. He'd been in a vegetative state for 15 years. What happened was his doctors stimulated the vagus nerve in his chest, and poof, he was suddenly able to react to visual cues, and he could even turn his head. He had been in a car crash at the age of 20, and when he woke up, he was 35. This whole episode reminded me of a question that gets posted to the internet once in a while, usually all sorts of interesting answers to it. And the question usually goes like this: what would surprise people the most about our society if they woke up from a coma or a vegetative state, say after 15 years, and were to just go outside and suddenly observe us in our daily lives? What would surprise them the most? One common answer is that they'd surely be incredibly confused, if not downright shocked, by the sight of very normal-looking cars pulling up to the curb, only for strangers to step inside and to suddenly be whisked away. 15 years ago, getting inside someone's car, getting inside a stranger's car, was a terrible idea, and, you know, everyone thought it could lead to you being murdered. Today, it's commonplace, and it's called Uber or Lyft, just to name two of these services. Now, popular private taxi services have totally changed our lives in that regard. They've put us all one single tap of the smartphone away from a stranger's passenger seat, or in the back seat if you feel more comfortable there. But have they also just shifted the danger in a different way, put us in a different kind of danger, one that potentially involves surveillance? In Istanbul, a new project is trying to connect the city's various forms of taxi services, and there are a lot of them there, to a single mobile app. One app to kind of rule them all, you could say, and one that collects your GPS data, your phone number, your credit card info, and even visual data from an in-taxi camera that's supposed to be installed in all of these taxis. The problem is, the app was created by, and it belongs to, the ruling political party of Turkey. Dorian Jones has this report on the iTaxi project.
Yolculuğunuzun keyfini çıkarırken nasıl ödeyeceğinize...
An advert informing people about the benefits of Istanbul's iTaxi. New taxis will be fitted with GPS tracking, allowing drivers to find the quickest and cheapest route, along with facilities to pay by credit card. All measures, the advert assures, aim to enhance passengers' experiences. The new taxis were announced to great fanfare. The most controversial measure is the installation of a large digital camera. Hayri Barachli from the city authorities proudly sits in one of the new taxis and explains the device is there to provide protection for both driver and passenger.
This is very important to ease the payment process, but more importantly, it provides security throughout the journey for both the driver and passenger. We have done it to make our citizens happier.
When you get in the taxi, the camera is clearly visible. What is unclear is whether it records sound as well as images, and where the images go. This driver is more than happy with the device, although he admits he does not know who is watching.
Yeni uygulama bizim taksi camiası için çok iyi oldu.
The new system is what is needed. I had an incident on Sunday night. If this system had already been installed, I could have been found immediately. I was attacked by a customer. If this system had been active, I would have been saved right away, or the attacker wouldn't have dared to attack. There is a camera system and a panic button now.
Not everyone in Istanbul is quite so positive, though.
As long as their voices are not recorded, I don't mind it.
And if the voices are?
Then it's kind of a privacy issue and I object to it.
Some bad guys are stealing money from the taxi drivers, or they sometimes do violence against the women in the cabs and things like that. I think that if they do this for real criminals, it's not a bad idea, but we have doubts about our government or our policemen are doing this about the real criminals or not. So it's the witch hunt is happening in Turkey now. So if they use it for things like that, of course it's not a good idea to have this kind of things in the cabs.
Nearly every week there are trials of people accused of being involved in last year's failed coup attempt. Currently, over 60,000 people languish in jail on coup-plotting charges. 4,000 others last year were prosecuted for defaming the president. Under emergency powers introduced following the botched military takeover, sweeping new electronic surveillance has been introduced, according to law professor Yaman Akdeniz of Istanbul's Bilgi University. He's been studying the rise of surveillance culture. Akdeniz warns concerns over the new taxis may be well-founded.
Taxi drivers cannot switch it off. It's a recording device. Nowadays, something like that looks very suspicious because we have no idea where data is transmitted to, or whether they have face recognition technology, or whether they have voice recognition technology. A lot of people are being investigated and prosecuted for allegedly defaming the president of Turkey, and the people are now more scared. If people believe the content of their communication might be slightly sensitive or critical, they started to use WhatsApp, Telegram, Signal, these kind of applications, because they believe their standard communications are not safe, because increasingly people are under surveillance and people don't know what sort of technology or what sort of things are deployed by the government authorities to monitor the citizens. And it will get worse because they're investing on infrastructure. A Big Brother Orwellian approach has been created in Turkey.
There is a growing sense of paranoia seeping into Turkish society regarding surveillance, and it appears not just to be fueled by literary comparisons about bleak futures. There's a saying in Turkey which goes, even paranoids have enemies. As reports of prosecutions and arrests for insulting or defaming the president are diffused and trials continue, any new innovation involving surveillance technology seems destined to be viewed with suspicion. Reassurances from ministers who say, if you have nothing to hide, you shouldn't worry about being listened to, are cold comfort in an increasingly dystopian future. Dorian Jones, DW, Istanbul.
Okay, we're going to move now to a very different kind of travel, that is space travel, and it's related to one of those announcements that was made and was easy to misunderstand or overlook or not really even grasp the implications of, and it was Russia and the U.S. announcing a, quote, commitment to build an orbiting lunar base. And don't be confused by the word base there, because this is not a base on the moon, which is kind of what popped into my head when I heard the word base. It is an orbiting base, or a floating station going around the moon in a stable, gravitationally bound loop. But the question is, why? Why an orbiting base, and why not on the moon? Fortunately, Germany's most decorated astronaut, Thomas Reiter, was able to tell me more. Thomas, my honest reaction when I heard this announcement was no, because I think a lot of people are hoping for a lunar base, you know, on the moon and not necessarily orbiting the moon. Why do this now?
Well, you know, if I also may answer from a personal point of view, this would be, of course, my wish that we see not later than end of the next decade, in fact, a human base on the surface of the moon. However, in contrast to the scenario that we saw with the Apollo lunar missions, it is the intention now not only to make a short visit to the surface of the moon, but really to build up a permanent station.
But I know we can fly to the moon, I know we can land there, and I can envision us bringing materials there for a lunar base. So why is it necessary to orbit the moon first?
Well, Mr. Dillon, you say we are able to land on the moon. I think if NASA would try today, they would have it would be a huge challenge. Even so, it has been done end of the 60s, beginning of the 70s. The blueprints are certainly available, but then to really implement such a program and to build a lander, a human-rated lander, which safely brings humans to the surface and back, this is something that hasn't been done since many decades, so it requires quite an effort to get back to this point. And as I mentioned before, as we want to do it now in a stepwise approach, this deep space gateway can help us to refine and to mature technologies like life support systems, to build them regenerative, because when we build a station or a permanent base on the moon, we need probably to use resources from the surface of the moon, like ice, water ice, which we can electrolyze and generate oxygen and maybe even fuel by using the hydrogen and synthesizing methane. These technologies, they should be matured in this next station. The second point is, of course, the radiation on board the International Space Station. The astronauts are still shielded by the Earth magnetic field. Once we are moving out further away, like to the vicinity of the moon, we are not shielded anymore by that. So this is another aspect where we are looking into new technologies, new materials, which need to be very lightweight and be able to shield us against this radiation.
Can you help me visualize the quote-unquote link between the International Space Station and the Deep Space Gateway? How does this work? Is there a shuttle?
This is not the link they have been talking about. A trip to this Deep Space Gateway would be launched from Earth and directly go to the Deep Space Gateway. However, as I was just talking about some of these technologies that we would like to refine and mature using this Deep Space Gateway, they are already tested today on board the International Space Station. Apart from this huge spectrum of various scientific research that we are doing on board ISS in many fields like biology, like medicine, material science, we are using ISS already today as a testbed for technological maturation. And this is the link between ISS. So we are sure that certain technologies work in the vicinity of Earth. Now we can put them a little bit further away. I mean, it's more than 300,000 kilometers away from Earth as compared to 400 kilometers altitude of the ISS. And this is exactly the link that has been mentioned here.
Now, the US and Russia have committed to this orbiting base program. Where's Europe in all this?
In those past technical discussions, we have been looking to various other options. The transportation system, Orion service module, is one of them. Other options that we are looking at is a kind of interface module with communication, with fuel supply, an airlock for scientific payloads. Also, habitation module, where Europe has quite a lot of experience. There we could collaborate with Japan, supplying the module itself, life support systems. And also a kind of a propulsion module, an auxiliary propulsion module, electrical propulsion. However, those contributions, of course, we need also to discuss with our member states of the European Space Agencies. I know they are very much interested, the European industry is interested, but at the end, of course, we need to decide if we make contributions in all those areas that I just mentioned, or if it will be just a section of it, and what will be the financial contributions, of course. So that is still under discussion with our member states. Take that moon or break it across the sea.
Everything I want is just out of reach. Well, our final topic today is a bit of a somber one, but it's an issue that needs to be discussed. October marks 60 years since a medicine was first sold in Germany, it was created in Germany, that ended up doing a lot of harm to a lot of people. With me in the studio today to talk about that is DW Science editor Zulfikar Abani. Zulfikar, what was this medicine?
Yeah, well, basically a drug known as Contergan or thalidomide came onto the market and was available on prescription. It's a sedative, actually, this drug. And as far as that was concerned, there was no real problem. So 60 years ago, it came onto the market. Within 4 years, though, it was withdrawn from the market. Why was it withdrawn from the market? Well, some doctors, and not only in Germany, but in other countries, there are cases as far afield as Australia. Some doctors found a secondary use for this sedative, and they prescribed it to women who were pregnant, who were having trouble dealing with morning sickness or nausea. And so they took this drug and apparently helped them. However, then all of a sudden, babies were being born with malformation of the limbs. It was a big mystery, and I don't mean that to be in a melodramatic way, but nobody really knew what was happening here until one doctor went out and tried to build connections between the babies and the mothers and what sort of drugs they were taking, not only specifically for the pregnancy, but, you know, just everything, you know, to build a picture. And that's how they discovered that actually as a result of this drug, Contergan or thalidomide, between 5,000 and 7,000 babies, perhaps some people say 10,000 babies around the world, were born with these malformation of the limbs. It's hard to know exactly how many were born with malformation of the limbs because many died during childbirth and only 40% have survived.
Was that common practice back during that time, back during the early 60s, to just casually prescribe a medication to a woman who was pregnant? I mean, how could they have done that?
Well, I think that, you know, the regulations were a lot weaker back then. Some things, you know, we've had to learn the hard way. We, doctors, the pharmaceutical companies, we've had to learn more than just once, because it's not just thalidomide that is an issue. There's another drug that is actually being talked about now as being re-reviewed by the European Medicines Agency. That's sodium valproate, which is a drug that is commonly prescribed to people who have epilepsy or living with epilepsy or severe migraines or bipolar disorder. So really very serious conditions.
And real quickly, this is a new drug?
It's not a new drug, no. I mean, this drug has existed since the 1970s. But there again, babies, so women who take this drug, who have to take this drug for their condition, say epilepsy, during pregnancy, have also had babies with birth defects, but also going to other sort of areas. There's not sort of necessarily only visible defects, but also things like autism, etc.
And just real quickly, yeah. So potentially since the 1970s,
yeah.
Women who are pregnant have been taking a drug that has potentially been harming their children.
That's right. Well, absolutely. 20,000 babies apparently in the UK alone, 4,000 in France. It's a French drug maker. The really shocking thing that has came out again in a hearing in London is that in this case, people did know. And so warnings could have been made to the mothers about 40 years ago. And it's only in the last couple of years that the drug maker has put large warnings on the packaging. Now, that's the one issue. The other issue that we should just touch on, though, is that actually sometimes it's like we know, sometimes it's we don't know. And there's a good reason why we don't know a lot of these things. I say good reason in inverted commas. It's a really difficult area to research. There is a report out called Designing Drug Trials, Considerations for Pregnant Women, that reckons that 98%, more than 98% of drugs, on those drugs there is no data or insufficient data for women who are pregnant.
Why not? This feels like a public health crisis. If you have 98% of drugs not they haven't been checked for pregnant women.
It's a public health crisis, and also it is an urgent women's health issue. And it's like sort of like this is another area where you feel like something's been overlooked, you know, for whatever, you know, reasons. There are perhaps good reasons why, you know, it's basically an ethical issue. You know, how do you get people to take a risk on their own life and perhaps the life of their child? You know, to get people to be part of a study that would find out more about these drugs, it's very difficult to get people into that. But we do need to know more. This report, as I mentioned, from 2014, says there are four really good reasons why. Pregnant women take 2.6 drugs during pregnancy. So there's a, you know, good reason there already. Pregnant women may have conditions that require them to continue to take their treatments. So like epilepsy or bipolar disorders, you know, think about what happens after a birth as well. Some women suffer from postnatal depression. There are also issues where medical problems can develop or resurface during pregnancy, and also the woman's body changes during pregnancy. So we need more data about drugs that women will take before pregnancy. We don't even know if it's like, you know, there's residue that stays in the body, but also during pregnancy and after pregnancy. So lactation. So when a woman is breastfeeding, for instance, there could be ramifications for the child, and we just don't know enough.
Zulfika, thank you.
My pleasure, Connor.
Well, before we go today, it's time for our social media wrap-up. So let's start with the most controversial thing that we posted to Twitter this week. And when I say controversial, I mean it generated the hottest debate amongst our users. And that was an infographic comparing two pieces of data. And what it compared was the number of shooting deaths in the United States as compared to the number of deaths caused by terror, by acts of terrorism. Now, I'm guessing that you can guess which factor caused more deaths in the United States, guns or terrorists. Well, in the 10 years between 2001 and 2011, so that includes the September 11th attacks in 2001, over those 10 years, roughly 3,000 US citizens died due to terrorism. Guns, meanwhile, resulted in 130,000 deaths. There was a huge discussion about what should or shouldn't be done about that under our Twitter handle or related to those posts. And again, our Twitter handle is @DW_SciTech if you would like to participate. On Facebook, one of our users from Kenya asked us this question. He said, "How does the ozone layer help? And what is its importance?" Now, that is obviously a very big question, a difficult one to answer, but the reason he asked us this, his name is Winston, by the way, is because every single week we publish a short online video on Facebook and on Twitter where we answer just these kinds of questions, and they have to be sent to us from our Facebook users to answer them. So if you are listening and you have a similar question about science, about technology, about anything related to those fields, please hop onto Facebook and fire away. We are at DW Science. Well, that brings this broadcast to a close for today. A special thanks to my technician, Gert Georgi, and to you, all of our listeners, for tuning in. I sincerely hope you come back next time for our next episodes. We've got an autumn special in the works that's going to be a lot of fun. And until then, and on behalf of all of my colleagues from the SciTech department, have a wonderful week ahead.